is Your Money. Hello, hello, hello. My name is Susie Jones, and I am the host, actually just setting the stage for our two superstars. And this is going to be a fun show, folks. Ask Bruce and Peg anything. We have on the air Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement and financial advisor. And we have senior vice president and financial advisor Peg Webb. All, as always, hello to both of you. Happy to have you with us on this this June 1st.
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Hello, Peg Webb. Thank you, Susie Jones. Wonderful introduction. Great to be with you. And yeah, Peg, Susie, June 1st. I know it's part me being older, but time just seems to go faster and faster the older you get. I cannot believe it's already June. I feel like the year just began, and we're almost halfway through it, and I just don't know where the time goes.
I know.
Part of that, I think part of that, too, is we're having so much fun. I mean, the markets are good. We're back. We, weather-wise, people are looking forward to summer, especially in the Midwest. And I would agree with you, Bruce, too. It's going way too fast.
So Susie set this up for us, Peg. It's a Ask Peg and Bruce Anything Day. So any and all financial questions, we will get to as many as we can in our time together today. But Peg, I'll let you lead. What are some of the things that you're hearing from friends, colleagues, clients? What are some of the prevalent things that seem to be on the forefront of people's minds these days? Maybe something you want to bring up to get the ball rolling.
Yeah, I've had a couple questions recently. Excuse me. One of the things is about these green energy projects that people are doing around the house, or they're hearing that the house passed some kind of bill. And it's actually called the Big Beautiful Bill. And I looked this up because I got this question recently, and it was headlines probably a week ago or so. I tend to not go too crazy when it's the House doing something, because I pretty much rely on the Senate. So what happened here was the House actually recently passed a law, and it's about this green energy. So we've had this for quite some time, where if you wanted to buy a car that had, the energy features, the electric vehicles, you could get up to like $7,500, and I mean dollar for dollar, off your old income tax, which is called a tax credit. That was a big deal, and a lot of people took advantage of that. Now, there's certain income limits, I'm not exactly sure, but that you don't qualify for that. And then there was other types of things that you could buy, like a home charger. It's all about clean energy. So I think we should wait and see what the Senate does, because I'm hear rumblings about them modifying it. I think they're in favor of it, but I don't know that it will pass in the same structure that the House passed. Bruce?
Yeah, I know a little bit about it also, Peg, and you're absolutely correct. The bill that, not just this bill, but any bill, if you look at how government works, anything that passes in Congress, then it goes to the Senate, and it almost never comes out of the Senate exactly the same way that it came out of Congress. So it's not law yet. We'll have to see what the Senate does to it. But the bill that passed in Congress would eliminate a lot of these incentives for clean energy. And so if the question is now a good time to do it in terms of getting the tax advantages, the answer might be yes, because it might go away. Now, I don't want to politicize this, but I have to admit, I have a hard time understanding the rationale or logic behind this. It seems to me that we should be trying to find ways to promote clean energy and have a better environment. We're all seeing the results of global climate change, and so I don't understand why the president wants to do this. Maybe there's a good reason I'm not understanding, but it's not a law yet, but the law might change, And so if you've been contemplating doing this, it's probably a good time because the law might change. It might not. The Senate might make adjustments and make changes, and then it's a question of whether or not the president will sign it as the Senate version comes out. But, I never make decisions like this, Peg, just for the tax benefit, just like I don't do charitable giving just for the tax deduction. So if you want clean energy for the sake of clean energy, that should be your primary motivation. The fact that you also might get a tax benefit is, just icing on the cake, so to speak. That's how I feel about charitable giving. If you can get a tax benefit, that's great, but that's not the primary motivation. And I don't think the tax benefit should be the primary motivation for somebody buying, an electric vehicle. But we'll see what happens. But, if you were contemplating it, and the tax benefit's important to you, you might have to act fast because it might go away. Anything else, or what else are you hearing, Peg?
Yeah, first of all, I'd love for listeners to know that today we would answer any of their questions. And I don't know if Susie mentioned it, but you can call the studio. We'd love to get phone calls or texts, but 651-461-9226. The other one, I think this is a good one in that people, during COVID, people were relocating, and they were relocating in many cases where it was a high tax state, and they were looking for a lower tax state because people were working remote. That has since somewhat changed. I'm hearing more and more about going back to the office and it being more mandatory than it's been. But during COVID and still today, there's high tax states like California, New York, I would say Minnesota, and people are going to different states. A lot of them went to Florida. I actually reside in Florida, and I have since 2020. But Florida, in any other state that you want to move to, you kind of have to weigh the pros and cons. Many people look at their income tax to say, wow, I could go from a 11% state tax to a zero, Florida tax. And that's just huge money. Well, there's other ways, though, that Florida, as an example, has to raise money, right? If they're not taking state income tax, then they're getting it from somewhere else. And so one of the things about Florida is that they have kind of a usage tax that if you want to go buy things, you're going to pay for things more, you're going to pay higher in Florida than you would, say, in Minnesota. And then the other thing is in Florida, and I'm privy to that because I live there, is that, there's a lot of storms there. There's been so many hurricanes, and I've witnessed now three and maybe almost four because it was a tropical storm, not a hurricane. But now the insurance costs in Florida are off the charts. And now we're starting to see a massive move of people from Florida to different states because they can't afford that insurance. So my comment is, and when I talk to people about it, you need to look at all the pros and cons and then also evaluate whether you really want to live in a sunshine state like Florida. And I get Florida a lot from clients, or Arizona. If you want to live in those sunshine states, then you really need to do your homework. And we help clients with that, Bruce.
Peg, that was so good. And again, I don't want to repeat what I said on the previous question. But again, I tell people all the time, this is exactly what you said, if you want to move to Florida or you want to move to Arizona, do it for the weather. Don't do it because of how much you think you're going to save in taxes. Because I think, yes, and Peg, you understand this better than I do. I have a Florida home, but I have an established residency there. You have, so you understand it better than I do. But what I tell clients is exactly what you said. There's no state income tax. But there's some other costs in Florida that you wouldn't have in Minnesota. and the net savings might not be as much as you think it will be. There might be some savings, yes, but again, if your primary motivation is to try to reduce your taxes, it's probably not going to be as much as you think. Go for the weather, go there for some other reason, but not the tax savings. And you brought up some really good reasons why the cost of living there can actually, you know, be higher in some ways. But, you know, and again, for people to be, you know, motivated to have a second home or change their residency, let's talk about changing residency, because what a lot of listeners might not understand is, so let's say you do move to a state with no state income taxes, and you think now you're going to avoid all these taxes. The state that you left, in this case, what we're talking about, probably the state of Minnesota, might take the position that it doesn't matter where you're drawing this income, what state you live in when you draw this income from your retirement plan. You resided in our state when you earned this money and you funded that plan, and we still think we're entitled to some of the taxes. So one of the things that we do at Wealth Enhancement Group is we help our clients establish a strong fact pattern so that if they're challenged by the state they left, they have a strong case to prove that they shouldn't have to pay taxes. And there's a list of, Peg, I don't know, it's 20-some bullet points that we give people that do this, do this, do this. You've probably done everything on the list, right?
Yes, and actually I worked, too, with my CPA on several things regarding that.
Anything else you want to hit before we go to listeners? You know, Peg, one of the ones that has been coming up for me, and I think the volatility in the market has probably been driving this, but I've been getting some variation of the question, you know, when is it time to reduce risk, to cushion the portfolio? What age do I get more conservative? How do I protect myself from volatility? Just sort of questions that border on that risk reduction idea as I head into retirement, or maybe I am retired. Are you hearing a lot of that? I think again, volatility sometimes drives those concerns.
Well, I'm smiling today because, you know, the month of May, we've increased 6% in the S&P 500. And do you remember, Bruce, like we started out the year, we had the election and just a lot of volatility, and on this show and in our daily job, we talk to people all the time about making sure that you have the right allocation. Now, I feel like people are going to go, oh my, yeah, she's talking about that again, you know, this risk tolerance and how much to have in growth and how much to have in income type of assets. Well, it's all based on your personal information, but let's just generalize here, is that most people are still going to be believers in growth, because if you're 65 years old or you're even 75 years old, we talked a couple of weeks about mortality and how people are living longer, and we just have to make sure that people's money are lasting. So it's the same conversations that I kind of have over and over and over again, and it's a good reminder, and actually for me to talk out loud about it all the time is helpful for me, because I am as, you know, I am as much, what would I call it? Like I don't want to lose any of my money either. I'm an advisor, but yet when it comes to my money, I sometimes have to ask people, well, what do you think's going on? You know, so we're all prone to maybe making the wrong decisions at the wrong time. So the listeners today, I'm hoping that you didn't pull out a bunch of money in this first part of the year, because unless you felt like, you know what, I don't have enough safe bucket. And if the market continues like this, I have to have money to be able to live on. So the closure of that whole topic there is make sure you have enough money for at least 2 years, if not 3 years, that you wouldn't have to tap into your growth side, and you'd feel much more comfortable and you'd sleep at night if you have confidence in your allocation. So I would say just contact your advisor, double check, triple check, make sure that you don't have to worry, because, by the way, that will age you. if you're a worrier, that's going to age you, and we try not to have clients be in that circumstance. Bruce?
Yeah, it might be time to make changes to your portfolio, but like what Peg said is, it shouldn't be motivated just because of a short-term retraction in the market. You know, as we get older, as we get closer to retirement, or maybe we're in retirement, our priorities change, right? When we're 50 years old, our priority is and should be growth. And growth means a lot of exposure to stocks. But as we get older, as we go from 50 to 60 and 60 to 70, maybe our priority changes from growth to preservation. Let's not lose what we've got. And maybe even maybe income becomes a priority. We need to take money off of our portfolio because we're not getting a paycheck anymore. So those alterations to your portfolio, changing the asset allocation model, maybe reducing stock, maybe increasing cash, maybe increasing bonds, is a natural progression that we work with our clients on as they go through life, as their time horizon shortens, as their priorities change from growth to preservation and income. So that's going to happen on a naturally anyway, but we don't suddenly make big changes just because of a short-term retraction in the market. So it always comes back to proper diversification, both in terms of asset classes or asset allocation, but it also, we didn't mention this, but it's worth mentioning, we also look at tax diversification. Do you have money in taxable investments? Do you have money in tax deferred and tax advantaged? And as we look at retirement income planning, we're going to make sure we've always got a good place to go get our money for lifestyle, and we spend the most efficient or the smartest money first, but we want to make sure you've got options of where you can go get that income. Okay, Susie, I think we've got a little time to get a listener question or two in yet in the first half.
Yeah, let's do that. Questions are welcome right now. They want to hear from you at 651-461-9226. I promise we will get your question answered. 651-461-9226. So go ahead and text that question to us right now, and we will get it. The answer for you. The question, the texter writes in a short time ago, can you talk about IRMAA and Medicare B costs? And can you explain what that acronym is for before we get too far? So I don't know.
Yeah, so Peg, the IRMA, I don't even know what IRMA stands for, what the acronym is for. But yeah, what they're talking about is that your Medicare Part B costs, because once you're 65 and you're eligible for Medicare, some people that aren't on it yet think that that's free. Only Part A is free. Part B, which is the majority of your coverage, does have a cost, and that cost is driven by your income and your income from 2 years prior to the year that we're talking about. So, but I don't know what IRMA is an acronym for, Peg.
Yeah, I didn't know on the top of my head, but I quickly looked it up. But because it does define exactly what it is, it's income-related monthly adjustment amount.
Wow.
So income-related monthly adjustment amount. Now, we have no real big fans of this IRMA, which I call a tax. It's a tax based on your filing joint tax return. And so each year they look at what is your filing tax return. Now, everybody under $212,000 as a joint return will pay $185 a month. And normally they'll take that directly out of your Social Security. If you're not yet taking Social Security and you're delaying, then you have to pay it in. But it's $185. And by the way, I said a joint return. That means each of you have to pay $185. And it goes up from there. The highest bracket is if you had a tax return, and we've seen this, Bruce, a lot of times where somebody sold a business or they retired and they got some kind of lump sum, and all of a sudden it's $500,000 or more, it's $628.90 a piece. If you have that situation, which technically it's a $1,886.70 per quarter. So a lot of times with these one-time events that happen, you can fill out a form and to send in with your payments and just say, hey, this is just a one-time thing. Can you give me reprieve? Or at least note to the IRS that you this was a one-time feature and that next year they'll put you back at the 185. But I don't know of a lot of people that like writing these checks. And it's actually almost easier on people, Bruce and Susie, because they pull it right out of their Social Security. And a lot of times if you don't have it in your hand, you feel like, you know, you never had it.
Bruce? Yeah, and really quickly, and I know we need to go to break, Susie, but the thing, Peg, to remind people that catches them is, for example, if you're talking about your Medicare Part B premium in 2025, it's based on your 2023 income. So it's 2 years prior, and that's the one that I think sometimes confuses or catches people because they're not thinking about that business or that farmland that they sold 2 years ago, and now it comes back to bite them 2 years later, and they kind of forgot about it. All right, Susie, second half, all listeners all the time.
All right, and if you are listening and you're having a question in your mind about Medicare or any number of financial issues, please call us right now, 651-461-9226. You can also text us at 651-461-9226. Welcome back to the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer and Peg Webb. And it is an Ask Peg and Bruce Anything show, which is a lot of fun because maybe you've got a question about your own Roth IRA. Maybe you've got a question about a 529. They are here for you. 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. You can either text that line or call us. We'll take a call from you. Absolutely. And welcome back, Bruce and Peg. Take it away, or if you want me, I will jump in with a question for you.
Thank you, Susie Jones. Let's go right to the questions. We're as many as we can today.
Okay. This texter writes, we sold our 18-year-old vehicle down to just one vehicle, want to buy a 2025 crossover and pay cash. Should we withdraw $45,000 from our Roth account?
Hey, Peg, this is a great question, and this gets into what we talk about a lot when we talk about tax diversification. And I know the texter didn't say this, but I'm going to give a little context. So oftentimes in our careers, I'm sure you've experienced this also, somebody wants to do the same thing. They want to buy something like a vehicle, and they don't want to pay interest costs, and they have enough money to pay cash. So they're like, well, why would I pay interest? But oftentimes over the years, I've had people that plan to fund that purchase with a withdrawal from a traditional type of retirement plan, a traditional 401k or a traditional IRA. And if the purchase price, as the texter is suggesting, is $45,000, they might have to take $60,000 or $65,000 out of their account to net $45,000 after they pay the taxes. And it would have maybe actually been cheaper to finance. But in this case, the texter is talking about, I assume, a tax-free withdrawal from a Roth IRA, but I think it's important that we give context to, you know, the tax ramifications of where the money's coming from and paying cash versus financing, not just on a vehicle, but maybe any big-ticket item that we're going to buy. Peg, thoughts?
Yeah, it's so interesting, Bruce, because the Roth IRAs actually started in 1998, which it's hard to believe, number one. And I have always, always in my career doing this job, thought they were like the most precious account that you could possibly open, right? Just a big fan. You know, we don't have a lot of options that are tax advantaged. So then clients started asking me, hey, I want to make this purchase, but, you know, I figured out the math, or they called their own personal CPA and they said, we ran it by that person, and I have to pay like 33% more. I have to take those dollars out of my traditional IRA. And so now this car is feeling very expensive. So it was probably about 10 years ago that I thought, you know what? These people could sell some of their Roth IRA and use it for a vehicle or a bigger purchase or something like that. So it took me a little bit of time to say, what do you mean you're gonna sell out of some of your precious tax advantage money? But yet in this case, I think it can be a very good idea, provided that you're not left with just a whole taxable amount of money. Like you're just going to take out all your Roth and now you're left with just a huge taxable pot of money. So that is my history with these Roths. And I'm saying more so today, go spend part of your Roth on something like this. Bruce?
Yeah, Peg, that was really good. And the reason I think that was so insightful is that you admitted your own sort of personal feelings about, hey, I don't want to spend this really, really, really good money, this really great idea that I invested in. And I've had clients like that before that, like, I don't want to spend this. And to that, I would say, and to you, if you the same kind of thing, well, what was the purpose of why you put the money in this Roth? Was it maybe to have a source of tax advantage retirement income? Isn't buying a new vehicle when you're retired one of the reasons why you did this? This seems to me like it's a really good thing to spend this money on. On the other hand, Peg, I have clients, and I know you do too, that they see their Roth as a legacy asset. They see it as a way of leaving money to the next generation without having a tax lien on it. And so they prefer not to spend that unless they really have to, because they don't want to leave the kids the traditional retirement plan, because then they're also leaving them the tax burden that goes with it. And so they like the Roth as a legacy asset. So I don't know the texture situation in terms of what other assets they have and what legacy planning is a high priority or not. But just based on what we know, yeah, I like the idea of taking money out of your Roth to go buy a big ticket item like that and not have to pay interest charges and not have to pay taxes, and your $45,000 vehicle actually only costs $45,000. Susie?
651-461-9226. A texter writes, I've never thought about using the high deductible insurance plan at work and thus be eligible for the HSA savings plan. But I might be if I can use the account tax-free in the future to pay Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare and Medicare supplement insurance premiums. Can you do that? Question mark?
Yeah. So, Susie, there's probably about a half a dozen questions there, Peg, and that short little text. So, Peg, speak to high-deductible insurance plans and health savings accounts. And there's probably a couple different roads you can go down. I'll let you go first.
Yeah, a high deductible. So there's two types of plans, and I call them, the first one is just a traditional plan, one that we know and we've had for decades of time. And a traditional plan usually costs you a lot more money out of your paycheck. But then they came out with this high deductible plan, which means you are willing to pay yourself. And it's usually between, I think it's $6,000 or $8,000 or something, where you have to pay your health insurance up front, like if you have a claim, and you have to spend through that before you're going to have the insurance company paying more. So you have a lower amount that comes out of your paycheck. So for the privilege of being able to do this high deductible plan, you can put money in what's called this health savings account. And if you put money through your paycheck in this health savings account, and there's a maximum that you can do per year, then that money, not only do you get the deduction, but you also get that bucket to grow tax-free. I'm a huge fan of those plans. I personally have one. Now, I would also, though, I encourage people to look at their medical and what, how do I say this? You have more claims than the average person. Sometimes clients go year to year where they may have a standard plan and they want to have a standard plan because they know they're going to have this huge operation or something, and, you know, they're not on Medicare yet. That might be a reason to go with the standard. And then the high deductible, you know, maybe for people that, I don't have a lot of claims, and I'd love to access this health savings account. You know, people who have these health savings accounts, they're growing quite large because they've been willing to go into the stock market. And now they're asking questions about, like, when would I use this? I mean, am I going to use, and I'm talking about like $200,000 some people have in this. They're saying, well, what should I, you know, should I be using it? I would say in a lot of cases, people should probably be using it because if the next generation gets it, it will be taxable to them. They're not going to get that tax-free status. Bruce?
Yeah, that was really good. I'll just add a couple of things, Peg. So the high deductible insurance plan, you know, some people should not be on that kind of a plan, right? If you have multiple kids still in school that get sick because they're, you know, interacting with, you know, with a lot of people, teenage drivers, kids playing sports, they play hockey or football or lacrosse. I mean, if you have a lot, go to the doctor a lot, which you usually do if you have kids, you should not be on a high deductible insurance plan. But if you're somebody that doesn't go to the doctor much, that doesn't, you know, have a lot of medical expenses, the high deductible plan might be a good fit. And if you are on a high deductible plan, you should absolutely, I agree with Peg, I'm a huge fan, you should be participating in these HSAs or health savings accounts. And again, think about this. Peg said it, but I really want to emphasize it. You get a deduction for your contribution, like a traditional IRA or traditional 401k, but you also get tax-free withdrawals like a Roth. You get to have your cake and eat it too. So the tax-free withdrawals have to be for qualifying health care expenses. And like Peg said, what most people do, myself included, most of my day-to-day stuff that I have now, I just pay for it out of pocket. I don't file a claim on my HSA. But I'm assuming at some point in time, I might need knee replacements or hip replacement or something like that, some big ticket item that I'll use the HSA for with a tax-free withdrawal. But if I never have that big ticket item and I get to a certain point down the road and I think I got all this money sitting here, I got to do something with it, you can actually reimburse yourself tax-free for all those expenses you incurred for all those years as long as you can, you know, verify those expenses. And I think I've talked about this on the show before. Most people probably keep track of that stuff on a computer, on a computer program. I have a manila file folder, a hard copy with actual copies of all my receipts, and I save everything in a manila file folder. So if I ever want to go get a tax-free withdrawal out of my HSA to reimburse myself, I can show the IRS the receipts that I've, the expenses that I've incurred out of pocket. So yeah, I agree, Peg. Huge fan of the HSAs. And in my experience, people that are eligible are on a high deductible plan. A lot of people either aren't contributing or aren't contributing as much as they could be. And I really encourage people to get as much out of those HSAs as they can, put as much into them as they can. But right, not everybody should be on a high deductible health plan. Some people absolutely should not. Susie?
651-461-9226 if you have a question for Bruce or Peg. A texter writes, I am 7 years retired. I have a small pension, IRAs, and a 401k. I am taking Social Security. All of my income is taxable. Did my investments and income, is it too late to make any changes to get out of that situation with everything being taxable?
So Peg, this again is a classic example of what we talk about a lot, that that people don't create what we call tax diversification. Now, when the texter says everything is taxable, there is a difference between taxable investments where you might be able to pay long-term capital gains rates or a lower tax rate than ordinary income tax rates. Then there's traditional retirement plans where everything comes out at ordinary income tax rates. So there is a difference between tax deferred and taxable, but it sounds like the texter doesn't have anything tax advantaged. And we talk to people all the time. The best way and time to create this tax diversification is while you're still working and you're saving and investing money, to do it along the way, along your career path, put money into all three types of tax category. But it's, Peg, and I think what the texter's really getting to is, if I didn't do that, is it too late for me? Are my hands tied? And the answer is no, there might still be some things they can do, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, we do see this circumstance a lot when people come and interview us for the first time, because we're kind of conditioned, right, to hide money from ourselves by just having it taken out of our paychecks. And for a long time before Roth came around, we were all putting it in and taking a deduction. And then even though Roths were established, as I said earlier, in 1998, our employers didn't have the method of being able to choose, do I want to do a Roth IRA with my company, or do I want to do a taxable tax, or do I want to take the immediate tax deduction? And so we do see that most people have a higher bucket of what we call this tax deferred, a big IOU to the IRS. You know, Bruce, there's some small things you can do, but number one, I think where the biggest question here was, how do I get to not have my Social Security taxed to the degree that it's getting taxed? Because that's usually a little bit misunderstood. And if you are a joint filer, married filing jointly, you can only have under $32,000 of income, and that includes your Social Security. So there's very few people that I see that have zero tax on their Social Security. And then it jumps up from $32,000 to $44,000 for 50% of it being taxed, and then 85% if you're over 44%. And I don't mean they're taking that as a tax. They're just saying these are your bogeys of how much you're going to have to pay on your Social Security. And all these tax returns that I look at, very, very few people get to have their Social Security tax-free. So what could you do? You could do itty-bitty, you know, maybe Roth conversion. So if you have IRAs that are taxable, you could work with a CPA or your advisor and say, okay, how much pain would it be to convert to Roth over time, and would that assist me on paying less Social Security? Possibly. I don't see a lot of tax returns where that's easy to do, because the taxes just get so high. Or you could do a huge Roth conversion in 1 year, and then you're all done. And then Roths aren't considered in your Social Security unless you take a distribution out of them. Bruce?
Yeah, and that's kind of where I thought you would go, is that it's not too late. You might be able to do Roth conversions. Again, as Peg said, a lot of things to consider there. Not only your taxes in the tax year that you do the conversion, but how is it going to impact your taxes on your Social Security benefit? And might it, this question came up earlier in the show, this idea of IRMA, might it impact your Medicare Part B premiums 2 years down the road? But I will tell anyone listening right now, and I'm not trying to do a commercial, standard operating procedure at Wealth Enhancement, we help our clients determine, number one, should you do Roth conversion or not? Does it make sense? And number two, if it does, how much per year should you do? And not to oversimplify this, but kind of the sweet spot when it makes sense is after you've retired, but you're not yet drawing Social Security, so your taxable income might be way lower. Another sweet spot might be after a big retraction in the market where the account balances on those traditional plans have gone down, it might be a good time to convert. But whether you should or not is something we do for all of our clients on a regular basis. That's a subset of comprehensive financial planning. Susie, I think we have a caller on the line.
Well, we had Joanne from Oakdale, but the line just dropped, so we're not exactly sure what happened there. But we do have more questions from our listeners. 651-461-9226. Joanne, if you are listening and you want to call us back, we'd love to pop you back on the air. 651-461-9226. A texter writes, how can a person change a paper stock certificate into a DRS?
DRS. Peg, do you know what DRS? I don't even know what that stands for.
Well, it probably is just on paper, right?
Right.
Your stock certificate is on paper. So every company that issues stock has a, not a custodian, but like a representative, kind of a bank firm that takes care of knowing who's got stock. Now, the way that I find out is if that stock pays dividends. So first of all, you got to find out who the trustee is kind of that stock. If it pays dividends, then that trustee would be sending out the dividends. And then we assist our clients if you have those certificates and you want to get them in book entry is what we call it, just on paper. Then you have to send your stock certificate and then they'll show it to you, you know, kind of like today, all our holdings are kind of just on the internet or book entry. And then you don't have to worry about, you know, maybe you're worried about your heirs if something happens to you that they won't even know that you have this stock. So that's a couple options there, Bruce.
Yeah, I'll just add to that a little bit, and we probably this will eat up the rest of our time. But, Peg, a lot of times over the years, I've actually had clients bring in stock certificates that maybe they inherited this from parents, or sometimes they don't even know, you know, how they got it or when they got it. They don't know their basis. They don't know what the stock's worth now. In some cases, it's a company that was acquired and it's changed ownership, so they still actually own stock, but it's in a new entity that it just doesn't say on their stock certificate. And what I know nothing, but my team has always been able to help these clients track that down based on the stock and the certificate number, and to find out is there still a value, can they sell it, what can they do with it, how much is it worth. So I know we've had that happen countless times over the years. It's a logistical kind of mess and nightmare, but we'll always help people do that, and I think we've been able to do it successfully. But honestly, I'm holding up my hand saying that's something I delegate. I never got involved, but I know we do it. Susie, I know we're about out of time. Thank you, listeners. A lot of good questions today. Good show. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you did not get your question answered, you can email it to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, or call this number, 1-888-6-ADVICE, 1-888-6-ADVICE, and set up a free consultation. Have a great day. Back after this.